You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Republican National Committee would like to unite the party, but with the competition of its two main factions growing more contentious daily, the challenge for Michael Steele has been daunting. And now there's talk of a purity test for candidates running next year, as some in the GOP argue that the road to victory is to embrace conservative principles they say that are at the core of the party. The other camp argues that the party must encourage divergent views if they hope to win. A snapshot of this conflict is playing out in the Texas primary fight between incumbent Governor Rick Perry and his challenger, Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison. Robert Draper wrote about the race for the New York Times Sunday magazine, and he joins me now to discuss this emblematic, contentious race. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me, Leonard.
You argue in your piece that the contest's central question, whether a highly popular general election Republican Hutchison can defeat a less popular Republican, Perry, who nonetheless knows how to excite conservative primary voters. And that goes to the heart of the GOP's overall vitality. Well, why would somebody who's been generally unpopular be winning? So far, he's leading in the polls, isn't he?
He is. At this particular moment, he appears to be leading by 11 points. And the reason for that is a reason or is a factor that we've been seeing in contests throughout the United States, which is that he's a good Republican primary candidate. He knows how to excite the base, and the base is highly conservative. And so Governor Rick Perry has been attending tea parties. He alluded to the possibility of Texas seceding from the Union. He has said the kinds of things that identify him crisply in the minds of the Texas electorate as a true conservative, where Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, in her efforts to broaden the Republican Party, has correspondingly become more muddled. So she herself now faces the challenge of, at least for the primary, so as to attract those voters, of appearing more conservative. And so in many ways she's attempted to adopt Perry's language while criticizing him at the same time.
You quote the veteran political handicapper Charlie Cook, who observes, in a primary, shrillness matters. It's a race to the fringe. So will the tone of the race change after the GOP primary?
Now, of course, bear in mind, Leonard, that you know, Texas obviously is not New York. It's a red state. Despite all the demographic suggestions that it will go purple and perhaps blue a couple of decades from now, it is safely in the red column. It's not as if all the language is going to center on government services and the environment in the fall. Whoever wins will, if not move toward the center, will have to at least begin to tamp down the kind of, you know, harsh or base agitating language that you tend to see in the primary, because they're likely to face a pretty strong Democratic challenger in Houston Mayor Bill White. And of course there's the problem. I mean, this presupposes that the general public will have amnesia after March the 2nd when the primary takes place, and will forget the language that has been used to appeal to the far right. The concern on the part of the Republican Party is that in an effort to win the primary, you know, either of these candidates will basically use rhetoric that turns off independent voters and keeps them out of the Republican column.
Now, the Republican gubernatorial primary isn't until March 2nd, 2010. That's months away. But it seems to be in full swing already. Who has the stronger war chest?
Well, they both have a lot of money, they both have excellent name identification. The problem, I think, is that Senator Hutchison, who has made no secret of her desire to return home to Texas and thus to be governor there, has, beyond that basic desire, not really defined just what it is she intends to do as governor of Texas and how the state would look different under her. There seems instead, at least in the minds of some, to be kind of a sense of entitlement on her part that I've been a faithful U.S. senator for a while. I have done well for my Texas constituents, but I've wanted to be governor. I made a an overture to be governor in 2006 or for the election cycle of 2006. Governor Perry prevailed upon individuals to have me, Senator Hutchison, not run for that, with the understanding that when I did want to come and run in 2010, that he, Rick Perry, would step aside. He has not done so. That's not fair. It's my turn. All of that has a strong element of truth to it, but it's not very compelling to persuade voters to go her way.
Well, it's early in the season, but as you note, the ugliness is mounting between them, and their nicknames are indicative of the nastiness. He's Slick Rick, she's Kay Bailout. Bailout because she voted for the economic recovery package?
That's right, and you know, Hutchison, this has been a problem, I think, for so-called moderate Republicans, and God forbid, by the way, that you should call yourself a moderate Republican in the state of Texas. That's the kiss of death. But anyone who did vote for the TARP bailout package of last October of 2008 is, you know, gets that wrapped around their neck. And Senator Hutchison, in explaining the vote to me, you know, sort of used this tortured formulation of, well, you know, at the time it was explained to us that this would be absolutely necessary to stave off perhaps a Great Depression. Had I known then what I know now about precisely how the money would be used, I would not have voted for it. I'm disappointed in it now. And actually, there's an intellectual honesty to what Hutchison is saying, but it sounds, as I point out in the piece, you know, rather John Kerry-esque, that I voted, you know, for it before I voted against it. And that disclarity is exactly the kind of thing that pure conservatives such as Rick Perry can point to and say, you know, this person's basically akin to a big government liberal and supports these massive bailout programs that we find so upsetting.
And he links her to Washington. He does everything possible to badmouth Washington. And she has been a senator for quite a while.
She has, and this, you know, has become in, you know, sort of Tea Party America now, where all evils are attributed to the Washington mindset, to Democrats principally, but also just to the way Washington thinks. The worst thing imaginable you can say about a person is that they're from Washington. And so Governor Perry has been saying this about Senator Hutchison, saying basically that anyone, not just Hutchison, but also prominent Texas Republicans, such as Dick Armey and former Senator Phil Graham, are forever tainted by having been in the Beltway for as long as they have. This, by the way, has not prevented Rick Perry from accepting the endorsement of Governor Haley Barbour, who was practically the founder of K Street, as one of Washington's preeminent lobbyists. But it's clearly a tactic that's gotten under Senator Hutchison's skin. And so, you know, when I followed her around in Texas, she made a point of dressing up basically like a cowgirl. She looked a little bit ridiculous, to tell you the truth. Like, you know, it was a Halloween costume. But every place that she went to, they had stage props of bales of hay and longhorn steers and all of the language she used was studiously anti-Washington rhetoric, talking about how she was going to fight like the devil to avert a government takeover of our health care system. And so she is quite conscious of how potent the Washington label can be as it's used against her.
Well, Governor Perry got a lot of national attention for his remarks that Texas might consider conceding from the union, and maybe we should play that clip.
I think there's a lot of different scenarios. Texas is a unique place. When we came in the union in 1845, one of the issues was that we would be able to leave if we decided to do that. You know, my hope is that America, and Washington in particular, pays attention. We got a great union. There's absolutely no reason to dissolve it. But if Washington continues to thumb their nose at the American people, you know, who knows what might come out of that. So, but Texas is a very unique place, and we're pretty independent lot to boot.
Now, I don't want to correct his English, but nothing can be very unique. It's either unique or not unique. But is there a constitutional lawyer who agrees with his read of the 10th Amendment and the agreement that brought Texas into the Union?
None that I found. And in fact, Governor Perry, at a roundtable with Washington journalists that I attended, suggested when one of the journalists asked him who really believes that you know is schooled in this, that Texas can secede from the Union, Perry responded that, well, look, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, and I'm sure constitutional lawyers can reasonably disagree on this. You could ask Alina Graglia, who is a very conservative legal scholar, or a Larry Tribe, who is a liberal scholar, and you're likely to get different opinions on the subject. I actually telephoned both of them, and they both said, no, there's really no ambiguity. There's a and in fact, Governor Perry has found one thing that the two of us agree on, which is that Texas cannot secede from the Union. In fact, what Texas can do, what the agreement was, the agreement when Texas entered the Union was that it was empowered, if it so chose, to split into four or five states. I'm not recalling off the top of my head, but one of those. But there was no provision that it could secede from the Union. So that's a mischaracterization on Governor Perry's part. However, it plays into the kind of Texas braggadocio, and I'm allowed to say this as a native Texan, that one tends to see not just in Texas politics, but you know, in Texas everything. I mean, you spend any time in Texas, and advertising and all this, things are as big as Texas, or Texas proud, or Texas this, or Texas that. And so the very notion that Texas, having once been a republic, could do that again is an assertion of Texas independence that plays very well. And indeed, we saw that Governor Perry's numbers went up. He was after he had made that statement on April the 15th of this year.
Has he rejected all the TARP money that was available?
No. He in fact, I think, rejected something like 5%, maybe a little bit less than that. And I think that money was claimed by the Texas legislature over his mild protests anyway. So Governor Perry's kind of had it both ways, saying that, I'm against this stimulus money, but taking it all the same. Now, his response to me is, well, you know, I'm against the very concept of a stimulus, but the money's ours. We deserve it. We're the ones who sent it up there. But at the same time, it falls somewhat short of, say, the pure stance that Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina had said when he firmly rejected stimulus money, though that, too, was overturned, I believe, by the South Carolina legislature.
And that was before he visited Argentina.
Yes, before, in the Appalachian Trail.
You were, you may be a proud Texan, but you seem to be surprised. That's my sense in reading the article, when Governor Perry told you that Sam Houston would have made a better president than Abraham Lincoln, and we might not have had the Civil War if he had been president.
Well, you know, that formulation had just not occurred to me, and Governor Perry was saying to me that he greatly admired Sam Houston, who on a variety of fronts, he mentioned that Houston's wife had hoped that he would not run for president because she believed that Washington D.C. was a toxic, you know, element, but Perry had asserted to me that if in fact Sam Houston had run for president, that he had backing from a lot of people up north, that there's a good chance that he would have won election, and thus that he would have, as a person opposed to the Civil War, averted a Civil War. And I said to him that, well, that means that we wouldn't have had Abraham Lincoln, and he barely missed a beat before saying, well, maybe Sam Houston would have been better.
Spoken like a good Republican.
Like a good Republican, but like a good Texan too. You know, there are elements of this the whole Texas primary saga that very much apply to electoral dynamics across the nation, but others that are peculiar to this state, and that that sort of belief in the primacy supremacy of Texas characters like Sam Houston is endemic to Texas.
Well, since Abraham Lincoln was the first Republican president, you have to wonder whether he would pass this purity test that is now being proposed for GOP candidates. I'm speaking with Robert Draper, who has written about the race in Texas for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. You may have seen the article yesterday. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Robert Draper, who wrote an article about the Texas primary race of the Republican Party for the New York Times Sunday Magazine. It was published yesterday. Let's talk a bit about Kate Bailey Hutchison. Her favorability rating has been consistently high. Public policy polling found that 76% of Texas Republican primary voters viewed her favorably. I would think that that would mean she'd be a shoo-in.
You would, except that her popularity has, as Perry's people have found in focus groups, been largely ephemeral, which is that they have a good sense of her. They like her. They believe that she has represented the state well. But when asked by a pollster to characterize just what she stands for, what she's done for the state, people tend to come up with no answer. And what this means, of course, is that she is ripe for being defined by the opposition. And Perry's people have gleefully done that, calling her Kay Bailout and suggesting that she's a Washington insider and completely out of touch. This is why Hutchison has done her best to come into Texas and talk about the, you know, parochial issues, about a proposed network of toll roads that Perry had wanted to do, the education difficulties that they're having there. But at the same time, her main difficulty is that, in fact, she has been associated with Washington, Washington-style politics for a while. Now, it's when that has suited voters, they've been pleased by it. Hutchison has been, in particular, very vociferous in her support of Texas military bases, and that has served some communities in Texas quite well. But, you look at her voting record, and though she happens to be very, demonstrably conservative on issues relating to abortion and guns and taxes and all that, she nonetheless has voted for virtually every appropriation bill that's come up, and these appropriations bills, have just an awful tangle of goofy projects, pork in them, and so you can slide her record under the microscope and find all sorts of things that are ripe for exploiting, and that's precisely what the Perry campaign is doing.
Although he has been vulnerable on all sorts of things as well, although there's not a major scandal, he has been involved in a number of things, including firing commissioners who might check into a decision he made that was probably the wrong decision.
In particular, this past September, he replaced three members of the Forensic Science Commission, which is a state board that was about to revisit the case of a Texas inmate who had been executed for killing his three children in an arson blaze, but who, all the way up till the time he got the needle, was maintaining his innocence. This is Todd Willingham I'm referring to. And there had been, for example, a very lengthy New Yorker piece suggesting persuasively to many that perhaps Willingham had it right, that he was innocent, and that there was this there was a report that was about to go before the Forensic Science Commission that was going to point towards that. That is to say that the state of Texas may have executed, with Perry signing off on it, an innocent man. So before the Forensic Science Commission was to hear this potentially damning report, Perry replaced three members of the commission, and he put in their place, in particular, put as a head of a commission this very law and order district attorney who was not known to give a second look at death penalty cases, who's very pro death penalty. And so this has been interpreted by many as Perry basically trying to rig the deal and trying to push away from the general public a public airing of a case in which the state of Texas may have wrongfully put someone to death.
He has endorsed Choose Life license plates for Texas. Would that be on all license plates, and is that something that plays well in the state?
It would be an option for Texas citizens, so it would not be a requirement that you have a license plate. Nonetheless, there were a lot of people who protested that this was a politicization of something that Texans carry around with them and was thus inappropriate. But there is a segment of the Texas public that would like to have that option. And Perry's well aware of that, and they're very well of Perry. I think the problems with Rick Perry have largely been that he has the state of Texas. Of course, everybody's facing economic difficulties now. Texas certainly is. But beyond that, Texas ranks near the bottom in teen birth rates, in high school dropout rates, in number of people who have health insurance. Despite the fact that there are a lot of Fortune 500 companies in Texas, despite the fact that there are pockets of wealth, there are also spreading pockets of poverty and worrisome indicators for the state that it has been lagging behind and will continue to. And in particular, the problem that is salient for Texas on political and social fronts is that the fastest growing demographic is Hispanic, and that also happens to be where there's the most poverty. And this has been something that certain Texas Republicans have been on red alert about, Karl Rove and George W. Bush among them. When I used to be interviewing then Governor Bush back in the mid to late 90s, he talked expansively and really very articulately about the importance of understanding the needs of Hispanics, both in terms of the vitality of the state and in terms of the overall health of the state Republican Party. But that does not seem to be something that Governor Perry has been particularly attuned to. And in this particular race, neither Hutchison nor Perry talks much, if at all, about Hispanic issues. Kay Bailey Hutchison does not yet have a Hispanic website. Perry put his up just only a couple of days ago. And so despite the fact that this is a very important demographic and one that perhaps could turn Texas ultimately into a blue state, it's not something that the two leading Republican candidates are paying much attention to.
I'm talking to Robert Draper, whose article about the primary in Texas says emblematic of a situation in the Republican Party was published in yesterday's New York Times Sunday magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. And Republicans, we should point out that Perry has distanced himself from the Bush administration. In fact, most of the Bush people are supporting Hutchison, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Yeah, with only really one exception, Joe Albaugh, who used to be the FEMA director and was Bush's campaign manager in 2000. But Karl Rove, Karen Hughes, Margaret Spellings, Jim Francis, Rod Pates, the former education secretary, are all supporting Kay Bailey Hutchison. And some of that is because they all have a personal tie to Hutchison. Some of it's because that they feel caught in the middle, because Perry did indicate in 2006 to a number of people that if Hutchison would step back that particular election cycle, then he would choose not to run in 2010. But others have noted the critical things that Governor Perry has said about his predecessor, President George W. Bush, when, for example, campaigning for presidential candidate Rudy Giuliani in 2007 in Iowa, Perry made the remark that George W. Bush was never, ever a fiscal conservative. He has not backed down from the opportunity to say that he was opposed to Bush-era initiatives such as federal encroachment into education on No Child Left Behind, opposed to prescription drug care for seniors, opposed to the budget deficits that took place under the administration. These kinds of things tend to get heard, and it's some of that. You see this a lot between two back-to-back governors, that there's always a little bit of friction and a desire to place your own stamp on the state. But in particular, I think it really riles not just people in the Bush circle, but a lot of people who feel fondly about George W. Bush. The two particular things. First of all, the claim that Perry has often seemed to make that Texas only began to prosper under his administration, which is, you know, factually, well, provably false. And secondly, that George W. Bush, whatever we thought of him as president, was as governor really believed to be. I mean, and was demonstrably a uniter, not a divider, to use his phraseology. And under the Perry administration, it has been anything but that he anything but. He has been very partisan, and sort of a my way or the highway conservative. And there are a lot of people who miss the old model.
Now, I mentioned that this race seems to be emblematic of the situation in the Republican Party. Republicans who support Perry argue that the future of the GOP in Texas and beyond requires buying into the assertion that yesteryear's Reagan Republicans and today's movement conservatives are one in the same. And they are describing themselves as the inheritors of Ronald Reagan's mantle?
Yes, and I mean, you of course... You hear Reagan's name invoked repeatedly, not just right now, but you heard, you know, John McCain talk about him a lot. I mean, Reagan is clearly his is the scepter that others would like to grab, but they have now kind of conflated Reagan Republicanism. I'm a Reagan Republican with the sort of activism associated with Tea Parties, and Dave Carney, the chief strategist for the Perry campaign, used those phrases interchangeably, talking about the movement conservative, which are the Tea Party activists and the like, and Reagan Republicans. And in fact, when I asked him, well, by, you know, where are you fitting George W. Bush in all this? He said, well, they're the Bush people are country club Republicans. And he specifically referred to Karl Rove as a country club Republican.
Even though Karl Rove had been a mentor to Rick Perry, hadn't he?
He had been a mentor to Rick Perry. He'd been a mentor to Dave Carney. And so that characterization, I think, would take Karl Rove aback. But he further went on to say, Carney did, that no one could possibly argue that there are Reagan Republicans and there are Bush Republicans, conflating again George Herbert Walker Bush, for whom Dave Carney once worked, and George W. Bush. So there was a time not so long ago, like last year, when most people saw a clear distinction between George Herbert Walker Bush and George W. Bush. But now, under the Perry model, there are Bush Republicans, and then there are Reagan Republicans, which are the same as movement conservatives, which are the same as Rick Perry Republicans.
And Sarah Palin has backed Rick Perry, hasn't she?
She certainly has. You know, and I think that George W. Bush remains an uncomfortable subject for people like Governor Palin, who speak very fondly of President Bush and don't wish to disparage him. Nonetheless, Bush wasn't a classic conservative, neither as governor nor as president. He was not shy about federal activism in things like health care issues and in education. And he was not shy about, introducing a budget deficit. I mean, he wasn't exactly a budget hawk. And so his policies, George W. Bush's policies, provoked some discomfort among the kind of activist conservatives you see, of which I suppose Sarah Palin could be named as one of. And so when the battle lines are drawn between a guy like Rick Perry, who is a movement conservative, a Tea Party Republican, someone like Kay Bailey Hutchison, who's a big tent Republican, it's very easy for someone like Sarah Palin to take sides. If you were to ask Sarah Palin, then if the world is divided up into movement conservatives, i.e. Rick Perry Republicans, who are also Reagan Republicans, and George W. Bush Republicans, are you going to reject George W. Bush? And I think she'd prefer not to answer the question.
Well, she says she's coming back to Texas to save the Republican Party, and her campaign argues that, unlike her, quote, arrogant opponent, she will restore comedy to governance and thereby make the ever-shrinking Republican Party more attractive to moderates. Now, as I understand it, there's an odd kind of registration approach in Texas. Voters re-register every 2 years, And can't voters choose to register with a party on the day of the primary?
That's exactly right, yes.
So she might very well pick up a fair number of independents.
It's possible. It's possible. But, you know, it still remains the case, Leonard, that there are, you know, March Republicans in the state of Texas, and then there are, you know, November Republicans. And there are a lot of people who may be registered Democrats because they're still in swaths of Texas, South Texas, and East Texas, so-called yellow dog Democrats, or at least that tradition. And though there are people now who vote Republicans, they may, because their father and their grandfather were registered Democrats, choose to do the same. And there is a sizable number of registered independents as well. The problem, you know, with Senator Hutchison is that though what you have described may theoretically be the case, that is that she could inspire people to register as Republicans, you know, basically the day of the primary, KPLA Hutchison really hasn't inspired anybody to do anything. I mean, after announcing at the beginning of the year that the startup of her campaign, it was a very impressive rollout of all these impressive Bush names, et cetera, her campaign all but evaporated. And Hutchison herself spent months dithering, to use the damning term that's used so frequently these days, about whether or not she should leave the Senate to run for governor, and if so, when, and would she get slapped down by the Perry people if she walked away from the health care debate. And ultimately, she decided that she would not quit at all. And to not quit at all as U.S. Senator then might lead some to believe that, well, she's hedging her bets. If she doesn't win the primary, then she's still got her day job. And so, you know, maybe she's really not all into this thing. So Hutchison has not been a very inspiring figure on the stump, and it's unlikely, therefore, that she's going to cause you know, hundreds of thousands of voters to do anything, much less register as Republicans so that they can vote for her.
Texas is a huge state and covers a wide area from the deep south across to the southwest. You have to wonder what would have happened if it had retained the right to divide itself into five separate states.
Yeah, that's, I mean, having lived, I've worked for 7 years for a very fine magazine there called Texas Monthly, and you know, routinely covered those areas which seem very, very different from each other. Yeah, nonetheless, though, the swamps of East Texas and the Rio Grande Valley of South Texas and the oil plains, the oil patch of Midland Texas that gave the Bushes their prosperity and their name may seem very different. There still is this unified sense of Texas, which actually a fellow who used to write for The New Yorker named John Bainbridge captured very well in a book of his called The Super Americans, which was published in 1961. And basically his argument, well, a very sort of de Tocqueville kind of argument, was that Texas was like America, except more so, you know, more sort of full of optimism and sense of possibility and reverence of bigness. And that Texas mythology really does captivate and unify all of Texans, which is why to appear Texas sometimes can kind of carry the day for you. I mean, in 1990, when Ann Richards ran against Clayton Williams for the governorship, you know, they had a lot of things on which they disagreed, but they both were very good at asserting themselves as iconic Texans, and Texans care about those who will present a great public face for their state. And I've since lived in North Carolina and now live in Washington, D.C., outside of Virginia, and I dare say that those areas, you know, do not kind of assert the primacy of their region, of their statehood, in a way that Texas does. So there are commonalities which both candidates will attempt to exploit.
We have no time left, but I just wonder about predictions, which can come back to haunt you. Are you willing to predict who's going to win the primary?
I am. I don't see how Kay Bailey Hutchison at this point, given the kind of campaign that she's running, can overtake Rick Perry. But on the other hand, Perry is, you know, he tends to say rather outrageous things. He could say something that could come back to bite him, and perhaps that'll give her a chance. And I think that's what they're hoping for.
And then, of course, they face, as you say, a strong candidate on the Democratic side. Is Texas ready to vote for a Democratic governor?
Well, they haven't since 1994 when Richards lost to George W. Bush. But if the competency issue really becomes a big issue, that is to say that voters get a sense that Texas has done poorly on key issues like education and health care under Rick Perry, then this very competent mayor of Houston, Bill White, does indeed stand a chance. And he's a very pro-business mayor, thought well of in those circles. So I would not write White off for this.
Thank you so much for talking with us again, Robert Draper, whose article on the Texas GOP primary is in yesterday's New York Times Sunday magazine.
Thanks for having me. ¶¶